From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A combustible brew in the East China and South China Seas right now. Fraught history, fierce nationalism, China's stunning economic rise, islands, blue water, and key natural resources. There is a brawl on, sometimes diplomatic and sometimes not, over high seas sovereignty. Passions are up. The United States could be pulled in this hour on point. Dicey times in the seas off China. You can join the conversation. Have you seen the images of passionate protesters splashing onto tiny islands, marching in the streets? Have you seen the gunboats? How should the U.S. respond? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Picture China, picture the Great Pacific to its east, and nearer by the East China Sea, the South China Sea, stretching all the way down towards Malaysia and Indonesia. Big claims there. China and the countries ringing those seas, from Vietnam to Japan and beyond. Fierce protests as well recently. Here's a protester in Hanoi, in Vietnam in June, talking about why she had taken to the streets to protest China's actions in the South China Seas.
The message we are trying to get out today is just like all the other times. We urge China to keep peace on the South China Sea and stay true to the agreements they had signed with Vietnam and other neighboring countries.
China and Vietnam have fought before, significant death tolls over these islands in the Philippines. Filipinos took to the streets as well in June, urging a peaceful resolution to their conflict with China. Here, a leader from that protest.
We are concerned that this problem is escalating militarily, as proven by the sending of warships and other military exercise in that particular area. We are calling for peace. We are calling for regional cooperation to explore the region in the benefits for the benefits of the Asian people.
And just this last weekend in China, here's a Chinese protester expressing outrage at Japanese claims to islands he felt rightfully belonged to China.
I'm not clear about the position of the country, but personally, I say we overthrow the small country of Japan.
Overthrow the small country of Japan. Joining me now from Hong Kong is Keith Bradshaw, Hong Kong bureau chief for the New York Times. Keith, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Paint the picture of this zone of tension right now, Keith, from, I don't know, north to south.
You have a series of disputes that have decades-old histories, many of them relating to Japan's attempt to dominate the region militarily during World War II, but others with sometimes even older roots. From north to south, you have Japan, first of all, in disputes with China, and also right now this week with South Korea as well,
right,
over a series of islands that extend from in between Japan and South Korea all the way down to about 100 miles northeast of Taiwan. That's the most visible of the disputes, with activists from both sides splashing ashore. And then looking south from Taiwan, you have the Chinese asserting increasingly claims to rocks off the coast, about 50 miles off the coast of the Philippines. You have the Chinese having cut the cables for an Indian research vessel under contract to Vietnam to explore for undersea oil reserves under the seabed in areas claimed by both Vietnam and China. And then finally, looking much farther down the map to the south, you have Chinese claims now to control something like 80% of the South China Sea, which is practically down to the edge of the territorial waters of Indonesia and near Malaysia as well. So there are a half dozen countries that have competing claims now to a whole long list of rocks and uninhabited islands all over that region.
Keith, for a lot of Americans, this is not big on their screens, but if you pay attention, we've got photographs here of what look like quite large demonstrations this last weekend in China. Small groups of Japanese, but very impassioned, taking their Japanese flag onto these little islands east, northeast of Taiwan, as you say. When you look across this arc of tension here, how volatile is this, really? It can seem so 19th century, these kind of land and ocean expanse claims to American ears right now.
One reason why they might seem dated to us is that a lot of Americans don't appreciate the historical context. but there are so many rivalries and animosities left over really from the days of people's grandparents. World War II in the Pacific essentially ended with the American occupation of Japan, and many in China feel as though China never really had its revenge or a full apology from Japan for the 14 years of often horrible suffering that Chinese people endured from 1931 when the Japanese army invaded northeastern Japan, China, all the way through the end of the war in August of 1945. So that lingering animosity is an underpinning of that. Now, at the same time, you have a rising China that feels as though it should play a more visible, more prominent role in the region, that interests of its that might have been neglected for decades should now be paid attention to. You have a younger generation that is far more nationalistic than older Chinese. You find the media also has become more free in China. And one of the things that sells newspapers and sells television shows and so forth in China is to be very outspokenly nationalistic. That's often popular. It doesn't get you censored the way expressions of interest in democracy can result in censorship. And so you've ended up with an often vociferous press within China that's encouraging a more strident position. Finally, you have factions or elements of the People's Liberation Army that seem to want to take a very aggressive point of view. It's not clear that they speak for the military more broadly, but it is very disconcerting when you see, for example, as we did last weekend, a major general from the Chinese army suggesting that the uninhabited islands currently controlled by Japan be turned into a bombing range for the Chinese Air Force and that the harbors be mined.
Wow. Wow.
That's not the kind of comment you can imagine an American general making on a territorial dispute, and the willingness of at least a few in the Chinese military to speak up on questions that have traditionally been political or diplomatic in nature shows how it's becoming increasingly difficult in China to rein in or criticize anybody who is taking a strongly nationalistic position.
Keith, what's
the government in China is trying to quiet this down some. They're trying to keep this to keep the lid on this.
What is the U.S. role, if any, in all this, Keith?
The U.S. role is very tricky. The dilemma for the United States is that so many of the countries that have conflicting claims with China are American allies, whether it is Japan, South Korea, not so much, but more South Korea with competing claims with Japan, the Philippines. You have the whole Taiwan question that has long been the biggest issue dividing the United States and China, the question that China regards Taiwan as a breakaway province. Even Vietnam, the United States now has much closer relations with Vietnam, and so it's awkward for the United States to see Vietnam and China sparring over control of elements over certain rocks and waters in the South China Sea. And then, of course, Singapore is a very strong American ally. Malaysia is non-aligned but has close relations with the United States. Indonesia is a good American ally. So there are a lot of countries here with conflicting claims.
You've got voices in the U.S. saying, get in here, U.S., and bring some order to this, or there's going to be trouble. On the other hand, you've got China saying, butt out, or saying literally in one of the newspapers there, you know, shut up, United States. This is not your affair. Which way does that seem to be leaning, in or out for the U.S. at this point?
The United States does not appear to have the United States has been leaning towards in the sense that you have the so-called Asia-Pacific pivot on the part of the Obama administration, which essentially means assigning a higher percentage of American military forces to the Asia-Pacific theater as the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan wind down. Now, to some extent, that's not new. What we're going back to is a pre-9/11 distribution of forces prior to 2001. That's what you're seeing. Now, the trickier question is, what does the United States say in public? Because these pronouncements by American officials, even seemingly minor comments, are seized upon in China and watched with great interest. And the dilemma is how to avoid fanning the flames of aggressive nationalism in China while at the same time not giving American allies like the Philippines or Japan any sense that they are being abandoned in any way. And that's a very, very difficult balance to strike. Moreover, the United States does not want to give too much encouragement to countries like Japan, the Philippines,
mm-hmm.
for fear that some activists or politicians in those countries might feel that no matter what they do, they've got the United States in their corner so they can make whatever assertive or aggressive comments they might wish.
Keith, I've just cut you for another 30 seconds. What do you see here? Is there a real flashpoint on the horizon here, or is this mainly just nationalistic theater?
The real question is whether we are seeing the beginning of a long-term, gradual rise in tensions. It doesn't look like this is going to lead to a rapid flashpoint. But is this the beginning of a long, slow decline that neither side can really reverse? That's completely unclear so far, but there is a danger of that, given how nationalistic the youth are in China in particular these days.
We're paying attention to the wider world today, and in particular sovereignty claims and counterclaims in the seas off China. Keith Bradshaw with the New York Times Hong Kong Bureau Chief joining us today from Hong Kong. Keith, thanks as always. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about sovereignty claims and counterclaims in the seas off China. High tension now between a rising power, its neighbors, and maybe the USA in the East China Sea, the South China Sea. Lots of response already online. Here's one listener says, the 1% in the U.S. are so heavily vested in China, I expect the U.S. would hem and haw a lot but actually do nothing here. Jim writes to us, do you think China does not remember World War II and 1895 when they tangled with Japan, lost islands then? Jim writes, it pays to be an aggressor. Ask the U.S. when it invaded Texas, Mexico, New Mexico, Nevada, Utah, parts of California, the U.S.-Mexican War. We were rewarded for being an imperialist nation in the 1800s. Maxie says, nations flexing their nationalistic muscles for the world to see who's in power. Secretary of State, U.S. Secretary Hillary Clinton, in Cambodia just last month, July 12th, talked about the tensions in the South China Sea.
No nation can fail to be concerned by the increase in tensions, the uptick in confrontational rhetoric, and disagreements over resource exploitation. We have seen worrisome instances of economic coercion and the problematic use of military and government vessels in connection with disputes among fishermen. So we look to ASEAN and China to make meaningful progress toward finalizing a code of conduct for the South China Sea that is based on international law and agreements.
Make nice, Hillary Clinton saying there in Cambodia just last month, talking about a code of conduct. But the conduct can get pretty rowdy sometimes over this. Bonnie Glazer joins us right now from Washington, senior fellow in China Studies at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Bonnie Glazer, thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Many Americans are not really dialed in on this. When you look at the East China Sea, China, Japan, when you look at the South China Sea and these resource claims and China's kind of big bulge that goes way down into that sea, do you see a serious situation here or a lot of theater, Bonnie?
Well, I think that the tensions are clearly rising, both in the East China Sea and the South China Sea. And the United States, I think, is trying to find an effective policy to diffuse these tensions. But so far, the U.S. has been unable to do so, particularly, I think, in the South China Sea, where there are a lot of interests in the economic resources, the potential oil and gas in those waters, fishery disputes that result from depleted fish areas where fishermen now have to go and fish farther from their shores. And then, of course, these claims over specific land features and China's nine-dash line that covers about 80% of the South China Sea. These are potentially serious. There has been an increase in acquisition of arms. For example, Vietnam is going to be purchasing 6-kilo submarines from Russia. And many other countries are also increasing defense spending acquisitions, seeking to defend what they claim to be theirs, their waters and these very small reefs, atolls, and in some cases small islands in the South China Sea. So yes, I think this is quite worrisome.
You go back not so many years and you had scores of Vietnamese dying on some of these reefs and islands under Chinese guns. China just recently looking at that big South China Sea bulge that it claims and making it a formal part of China, a prefecture or a kind of province with a leadership and representation. And describe for us, if you could, Bonnie, I mean, these Chinese installations built on reefs that barely make it above water or sometimes don't. And even so, China's building on them, it would appear, to assert their sovereignty.
Well, I think the first thing that we have to at least acknowledge is that China isn't the only country that is contributing to tensions.
Mm-hmm.
Indeed, in the recent standoff at Scarborough Shoal between the Philippines and China, which took place on April 10th and then lasted several months, it was actually triggered by a Philippine warship, which had been purchased from the United States recently, entering into the shoal and seeking to detain Chinese fishermen there that were illegally poaching. And the Philippines says not the first time they've tried to detain fishermen, but in fact it's the first time they used a warship. And the Chinese then overreacted pursued several actions, including economic coercion, which you just played a segment and Secretary Clinton referred mm-hmm. to this economic coercion. And what they did was they quarantined all of the tropical fruit that China imports from the Philippines. And this was, of course, clearly designed to put pressure on the government in Manila. So what you have
Not the first time we've seen that in their quarrel with Japan over islands. They denied Japan rare earth metals.
Rare earth minerals.
Critical for Japan's high-tech industry. But China said, look, you want to mess with our islands? Will mess with your economy.
Exactly. There is a growing proclivity on China's part to use their economic leverage over countries in order to coerce them to change their policies. There are several examples of this. In fact, even with Norway, when the Norwegian Committee for the Nobel Peace Prize had granted the prize to a Chinese dissident, Liu Xiaobo, and the Chinese cut off the free trade talks and stopped importing Norwegian salmon. So this is quite a trend and is a worrisome trend.
Let's hear a Chinese voice right here. This is a big and rising country with a long history that is very much on Chinese minds when they look out on these adjacent seas. Bonnie Glazer, please stand by in Washington. With us right now from Alberta, Canada, is Nong Hong, postdoc fellow at China Institute at the University of Alberta. She researches China's policies in maritime law, ocean governance in East Asia. Nong Hong, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, my pleasure. And why the sovereignty claims between China and Japan become such a nagging problem? But if you look at China experiencing hindering its land border with its neighboring countries, we can actually see that China has been making compromise in its land demarcation. But why between China and Japan, the Diaoyu Island becomes such a nagging problem? And as I heard from the previous speaker, well, the historical problem, because the Diaoyu is not only about the legal issue anyway, and it's not about who owns, who has more, much stronger evidence to show that who should own this sovereignty. However, it's more or less related to the historical context and political context. For a couple of centuries, that China and Japan has been experiencing political relations, but hot economic relations. Due to the historic context, for instance, the Japan's invasion on China and
sure.
Japan, well, those things will become a very difficult issue.
Nong Hong, let me ask you, if I may. You're talking about the Diaoyu Islands there. The Japanese call them the Senkaku. These are in the East China Sea,
yes.
off of Taiwan. We also have big claims that are being made by China and others in the South China Sea.
Sure.
There are a lot of countries involved here, but China's economy and its military might increasingly vastly overshadow the others. Do you presume that China's sovereignty claims in all of these cases will prevail? Will all of these smaller neighbors ultimately have to bow to a big, powerful China's claims on these ocean expanses? Nonghong?
Yeah. So, well, first of all, China's claims over the sovereignty over these sprightly terraces and other features in the South China Sea and also mm-hmm. the maritime jurisdiction is not a new claim. It started like 100 years ago. And the disputes between China and other claimant states like Vietnam, the Philippines, Malaysia, which is also no new, it started in early 1970s.
I know they go way back, but when you look forward, how do you think this will ultimately be settled? Will a powerful China ultimately have sovereignty over all of these disputed territories?
Well, the question is that I need to point out a very important milestone in 2002 when China and 10 ASEAN states signed the Declaration of Conduct on the South China Sea, under which both China and ASEAN states vowed to have peaceful solution for the South China Sea dispute and the regional cooperation. And they are now under discussion to drafting a code of conduct, which is a very important gesture between both China and Southeast Asian countries. But having looked at the period between 2002 and 2009, actually we see a quite stable situation in the South China Sea until May 2009, which is a very important period in the South China Sea. For instance, because May 2009 is a very important deadline for all these coastal states to submit it to United Nations, its claim over the outer limits of continental shelf, and everyone to want to expand the maritime jurisdiction zone. And because Vietnam and also Malaysia, they have submission to the United Nations, and then China has to react. Because those areas covered in the submission are actually under dispute between China and all the claimant states. So under international law, this submission should not be taken into consideration. That is why China protested to the United Nations, and that's why China, for the first time, deposited its U-shaped light map.
Let me ask you, if I may, Nonghong, do you think the United States has any role to play here, or should it stay out of this? These issues?
Well, it depends what we're talking about. If we're talking about the sovereignty issues, definitely it's between China and all these claimant states. But if we're talking about, for instance, regional issues such as maritime, marine environment protection, and marine search and rescue, we're talking about regional cooperation. We need all the efforts from the regional states. But I understand that United States' interest in the freedom navigation and also the region's stability in this region. And for this perspective, of course, China, United States has a role to play because the freedom navigation is a very important doctrine.
Sure, for all countries. Nonghong, please stand by. I want to bring one more voice in from one of these states you're talking about. Pek Kun Heng joins us right now, also from Alberta. Malaysian, professor at the School of International Service at American University. She's director of the ASEAN Studies Center. Pek Kun Heng, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hello, Tom. Thank you very much for inviting me on the show. I'd like to give some perspectives from the ASEAN countries. As Secretary Clinton says that the U.S. is looking to ASEAN and China to make meaningful progress on the issue. And ASEAN actually is the, I would say, the key, you know, the key platform.
Ringing the South China Sea, yes, okay.
The South China Sea, mm-hmm. That's right, yeah. So ASEAN itself has if you include Indonesia, a more recent sort of player in the fray, five countries with claims in the area.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, what ASEAN, and if ASEAN were to be important and useful and meaningful to a resolution of this issue, it has to have a common position and speak with one voice. And this is what, because China prefers to deal bilaterally with each ASEAN country, but ASEAN has taken the stand that it has to deal multilaterally with the 10 countries when it deals with this issue.
China has more power when it deals bilaterally.
One-on-one, and then divide them, because one-on-one, they're much weaker. But ASEAN is a bloc. It's a very important and strategic a trade partner. It has and any kind of instability in the South China Sea would also affect on China's own economic well-being. And the CCP, the party, has always been concerned to be a good a good neighbor to ASEAN.
If I may, Pek Geun-hing, do you think this will end peacefully? And what role should the United States play, if any?
I believe that, and I'm optimistic that it will not it will not break up into sort of a conflict. Because let me go back to see why I'm optimistic. So there was, in the last ASEAN foreign ministers meeting in July, from 8 July to the 13th of July, ASEAN was unable to issue a joint communique for the first time in its 45 years of existence.
Mm-hmm.
Its objectives and its concerns. Now, because Cambodia, believed to be under pressure from the Chinese, did not want to have the Philippines and the Vietnamese bring in Scarborough Shoal and exclusive economic zones into the wording, because the implication was that China has infringed upon Philippines and Vietnam's EEZs. So they did not issue a joint communique, which meant that ASEAN was in disarray. But a week later, ASEAN came back, closed ranks, provided a common position, spoke with one voice on the six basic points. Now, the six basic points go back to the Declaration of Conduct, which...
Code of conduct there. People are hoping that it can all be pulled into that kind of framework and resolve. Pek Geun-hing of Malaysia there saying she's... optimistic for compromise and a peaceful solution here. Pek Geun-hing, director of the ASEAN Studies Center, thank you for joining us today. And also Nong Hong, the University of Alberta, the China Institute there. Let me get a call right here. Thanks to you both. Ty in Boston's calling. Hi, Ty, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. I always appreciate your show. I would say that China has a way to nibble away at what it wants, not only South China Sea, but territory too. According to their motto, fight, fight, talk, talk, da, da, dam, dam. And they want to, when they talk, they want to break the chopstick of Southeast Asian country one by one instead of the whole bundle of chopsticks.
Ty, what country are you from, Ty? And what do you make of China's claims in the South China Sea?
My point is, I would urge the country of Southeast Asia and the USA and Australia to sue for a declaratory judgment at the International Court of Justice or the International Tribunal of the Law of the Sea that the claim of China on the sea, on the South China Sea, is against international law. And also their claim on the territorial claim on the islands also unfounded. The reason is this. There is no claim of sovereignty on the high sea possible under the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea.
Ty, if I may, just so we understand your perspective a little bit, what is your family's home country, Ty?
I am a Vietnamese-American citizen now, but
yes.
I was from Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
I was working at Harvard Law School in the last 30 years.
And you're looking at the international law, and you're not too fond of China's claims there. Ty, I appreciate your call. Bonnie Glazer in Washington, wow, we've got optimism there for compromise, but just clearly very, very difficult overlapping claims here.
Well, yes, I think you can tell that there's a lot of very nationalistic sentiment and hot-headedness involved in this issue. But I do think that the United States has a constructive role to play.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about sovereignty claims and counterclaims in the seas off China. High tension now between a rising power and a bunch of its neighbors. Bonnie Glazer joins us from Washington, senior fellow in China Studies at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. We will hear a little later in this segment some wisdom from the ancient Greeks about how big standing powers address powerful rising powers and what we might learn from Greek philosopher Thucydides from millennia ago now. Hannah's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hannah, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Thanks, Tom. How are you doing?
Well, what do you see?
Hi. I would just like to comment on my perspective on why these protests are erupting all over China. And, you know, the first thing, kind of building upon what other callers touched upon, that, you know, there's a long history of anti-Japanese sentiment in China going back to the late 1800s. And so whenever you see these kind of conflicts coming up and lots of people protesting, it's never always just about that island, not that small little island. It's you know, it's a larger problem. And the other thing that's interesting is when you look at protests in China, and, you know, it's interesting because many protests in China are not allowed. It's the protests regarding labor, land disputes are really vigorously put down by, you know, local forces, local government forces. And so why are these protests being allowed to kind of flourish in China? And, you know, because in a lot of ways, nationalism is often a tool by the central government. If you direct people's attention to these nationalistic sentiments, it really kind of directs people's attention away from any problems at home.
Yeah, you wonder just how long, how far they'll be allowed to go. Hannah, I appreciate that perspective from your time in China. One more here from New York, Amherst, New York. Harry, you're on the air.
Yes, I wondered before the program ends, Tom, whether you'd have some of your knowledgeable discussants speak to the point of the Paracel Islands. I have a map here in front of me, which was published, reprinted, mm-hmm. 10 times between 1935 and 1944.
Okay.
And it says Paracel Islands, China.
And, of course, these off Hunan, well off, but yeah, in the South China Sea and part of China's claim on that sea.
East of the 110th latitude, and they're out there opposite Hue in Indochina.
So who's the opportunist here then, Harry? What are you thinking?
Well, I don't know what to think. I was dependent upon some enlightenment from the people who are supposed to know about these things. I can understand why there might be or would be a conflict over the Spratly Islands.
Even further south, yeah.
Little coral reefs or something, but the Paracel Islands are distinctly here, and they seem to be substantial landmarks, land points.
Yeah, Bonnie, let us pick it up. Harry, thanks for your call. Bonnie, you hear Hannah thinking there about what's going on with the protests in China, nationalism, and history there as well. Harry looking at maps from the 30s and 40s, which see some of these islands marked as Chinese. I mean, you know, China has such a history. It goes back so long. It was a great power before it kind of stumbled and then felt and was beaten up on by outside powers. Is there the case to be made that, come on, these were Chinese lands, or is it that clear, Bonnie?
I think it's not clear. I don't think that any of the countries that have claims, and we're talking about China, Taiwan, the Philippines, Vietnam, Malaysia, mm-hmm. and Brunei,
yes.
It's really not clear that any one of them has a convincing claim over another. Some justify these claims based on history, administration, occupation, and naming, and others just look to the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, which was created in 1982 and basically allows for a maritime space to be claimed by a country based on a land feature. Extending from a country's coastline, they're supposed to be allowed under this treaty called mm-hmm. UNCLOS 200 nautical miles, where a country has their exclusive economic zone.
Right.
Recently, we have seen one of China's oil companies declare that there are blocks open for bidding in Vietnam's 200-mile EEZ, and overlapping blocks that Vietnam had previously put out.
Exclusive economic zone, but not exclusive if you're giving out leases on the resources there.
Exactly. So if these claims could be taken to the International Court of Justice, that might be one way of settling it, but none of the claimants, or very few of them, really wish to do that. And then in the case of the maritime claims, they can be taken also to the UN, an organization called the International Tribunal for the Law of the Sea, to adjudicate these disputes over maritime jurisdiction. But under international law, the land dominates the sea. So before these disputants can resolve the maritime space, they have to first determine the land features.
And who owns these little reefs and rocks and spits and things so small they can barely be called islands, but they're really important for those bigger claims.
Absolutely. And with global warming, many of these problems may go away because the water may cover some of these smaller.
Yeah, I don't know. From the photos I've seen, people may keep building even as the things sink out of sight. Tom in Lexington, Kentucky. Tom, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. This is a great discussion. I'm a former long-term resident of Malaysia and Indonesia, and I think something missing from this conversation is the historical nature of the conflict between ethnic Chinese and the ethnic Malays of Southeast Asia. That the Chinese have been settling the coasts of these countries for thousands of years. The Chinese have been trading and often taking trade advantage of the ethnic Malays. And when I lived there, especially along the coast of Borneo, in Chinese-dominated towns like Singkalang, the tension between the Malays and the Chinese was often palpable. And it seems to me that we're ignoring at our peril the historical nature of these tensions. This is not something that arose recently, and it's not something that will go away quickly.
Tom, it's a good point. I mean, major tension, riots in many of these Southeast Asian countries over the time, over the centuries. Do we see, Bonnie, a kind of ethnic as well as national tension being played out here? Is it unavoidable?
Well, there's absolutely latent ethnic tension, but if you look at China's relations with these countries more recently, in the 1990s, really from the mid-1990s, the last time the China used force was 1995 in the South China Sea, and then for a period of more than 10 years, there were relatively good relations between China and these Southeast Asian countries. And this, the ethnic conflict, of course, latent, absolutely there and in people's memories. But China managed its relations well, and many of these countries were willing to benefit from the growing economic ties with China. And it is the resurgence now of the tensions over these small islands and islets in these waters that has now brought some of these memories to the fore. It could be manageable if the Chinese were to return to the policy of not being confrontational and giving these other nations in the region the advantages of the economic relationship, setting aside the sovereignty issues and defining its claim to these waters clearly so that going forward there could really be joint development, exploitation, and sharing of resources, then it could be manageable.
That's hardly the tone lately, though. I mean, the foreign minister saying these are core Chinese interests. I mean, one wonders, with its rising power, its great power now, if China feels like it needs to return to those more modest cooperative claims. If you look at the history of countries, when they get power, it's not real encouraging. Bonnie Glaser, stand by in Washington. I want to invite into our conversation Graham Allison. He's director of the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at the Harvard's John F. Kennedy School of Government. He's got an essay in the Financial Times just yesterday headlined Avoiding Thucydides' Trap. And he takes us back to 5th century BC, ancient Greece, when Athens was the rising power, challenging Sparta, talks about when rising powers rival great ruling powers. He's pulling all the way back to the big frame here and the United States looking in on these territorial conflicts now along China's shores and out to sea, in effect butting up, whether it likes it or not, against China, seeing patterns here and problems in those patterns over time. Graham Allison, thanks very much for joining us. What's the pattern? What's the problem that you see sort of writ large around these claims?
Well, I think Keith started us on the right dimension here, that trying to understand this absent the historical context is just, leaves us flummoxed.
Mm-hmm.
I think going all the way back to 5th century B.C., Greece may seem a little stretch, but for international relations scholars, Thucydides' insight is one of the building blocks. And Thucydides, watching this Athens burst into a prominence in less than a half century.
Kind of the China of its time in the face of Sparta.
Mm-hmm. And Sparta was the ruling power in the Peloponnese, which was Greece, as soon as Greece, was shocked. And then Thucydides says in a famous and oft-quoted line, it was the rise of Athens and the fear that this inspired in Sparta that made war inevitable. So note here, there's two variables, the rise and the fear. And if one looks at, just as you said earlier, the rising powers disturbing the karma of ruling powers, usually this turns out poorly. Think of Germany rising at the end of the 19th century, challenging Britain. You get World War I and World War II. So in 11 of 15 cases since 1500, this turned out in war.
In 11 of 15 cases where a rising power emerged to challenge a ruling power, there came war. So if you're a scholar of international relations, you look at this and say, we've got a very strong pattern here, and with that danger in the current China rise vis-a-vis the U.S.
Absolutely, and this is not to say we're prisoners of some iron laws of history, but
let's not be.
That this, the magnitude of this challenge, I mean, the notion, and just even you can hear this in the conversation today, that there's something odd about a more powerful country becoming more nationalistic and more assertive and raising questions about arrangements that were defined by others when it was weaker and they were stronger is the historical pattern. And as I write in this piece, Americans should be very careful about recommending to Chinese that they behave like us, because if you had a Teddy Roosevelt in China, I mean, when Teddy Roosevelt, a kind of quintessential American, beginning of the 20th century, sure that this was going to be the American century, he thought it was absolutely crazy that Britain was the dominant navy resolving disputes in the Caribbean.
I mean, forget about it was his attitude.
Forget about it, absolutely. And when in the Alaskan Boundary Treaty, which was a dispute between the, in 1903 between the U.S., Canada, which was a dominion of Britain, and Britain, Roosevelt's instructions to the people dealing with the territory were, quote, not to yield any territory whatsoever in arbitration. Other than that, they could deal with it as they wanted, and they settled it exactly on their terms. And if you look at Alaska, you see this funny little strip of territory that is that separates Canada from the coast for quite a long time. How did that come to be settled that way? The answer is by threat of force.
I mean, this is when the U.S. was in the now China role, the rising power, and it went out, as you say, liberated Cuba, threatened Britain, threatened Germany with war in disputes around Venezuela and Canada there.
How did we get the Panama Canal?
Split Colombia.
A country that didn't want to agree. We sponsored a uprising. We recognized the new country instantly, and it gave us the deal for the canal.
And now we have Japan, an ally in this dispute with China, lots of allies and friends in Southeast Asia. It would be easy to get into some kind of tussle. There are many other reasons it could happen. It would be disastrous. It would be devastating. But you're right, Graham, that the fact that it would be devastating for both countries is relevant, but not decisive in determining whether or not in this dynamic, countries go to war.
Absolutely, and I think there we should all try to remember World War One. At the end of World War One, all of the contestants were defeated.
Yeah,
the Kaiser was gone. The Russian Empire, Russia was taken over by the Bolsheviks. France was bled for a generation. The Austro-Hungarian Empire had dissolved. Britain, its position was forever altered. So the fact that a war is stupid and would not result in benefits for either party is a relevant fact. It's extremely relevant. It's one to focus on, and it would be crazy for the U.S. and China to find themselves in a war from which neither would survive well. But the fact that it makes no sense doesn't mean that it couldn't happen.
I want to get Bonnie on this, but first, Thucydides. He saw the dynamic, you know, rising power challenges a standing power, and you've got trouble. What was his advice on how to avoid this, or did he have it?
Thucydides had fought on the Athenian side, so this is, again, a strange time. But he, as he says, thought that this was, quote, inevitable. So his was rather pessimistic.
Bonnie, here we are. You start off talking about China and its neighbors, but it's a Pacific pond. The U.S. is in it. And this is the rising power and the standing power. What do you see? Do we have the presence of mind? Are we on the right track to avoid conflict in situations like this?
Well, I think that leaders of both the United States and China are very determined to try and keep the U.S.-China relationship stable and improving. But at the same time, there are deepening suspicions between the two countries and growing strategic competition. And I agree with Graham that even though a war would be stupid, one could certainly come up with a contingency, even in a place like the East China Sea, where if China tried to seize these islands, mm-hmm. which they call the Diaoyu and the Japanese mm-hmm. call the Senkaku, mm. they are actually covered under the U.S.-Japan security treaty because the Japanese have administrative control
right.
over them.
And boom, there we would be by
the
treaty.
The United States would be there trying to defend those islands with the Japanese.
Not to mention Taiwan and all the risks. Graham, I want to ask you just very quickly here. You say China and the U.S. have to start talking more candidly about these confrontations and flashpoints. But more difficult, must begin making substantial adjustments to accommodate each other. Like what on the American part, Graham? Is there something the U.S. is going to have to give here?
Well, if you look at the successful cases, Britain's managing to accommodate the U.S. as the U.S. rose offers a number of instructive lessons.
20 seconds.
And I think basically it means that we should be extremely cautious about emboldening other people's claims to islands in which we have no stake.
There is a starting point, anyway, for the U.S. looking out on this, but there's all kinds of expectations built in, some by treaty, as Bonnie points out. Graham Allison at Harvard, Bonnie Glazer at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. Thanks to you both and to all of our guests around the world in this hour. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.